Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club to hear Alan Tudge, who makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. We got late notice about this, and we only heard about this on late Thursday afternoon, so Friday, Monday, Tuesday, and here we are. So many thanks for all of you for turning up at late notice. I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. Alan Tudge studied arts and law at Melbourne University, did an MBA at Harvard, worked for Boston Consulting, held senior advisory positions in foreign affairs and education during the Howard government, became the deputy director of the Cape York Institute, went back into business advising, and won the seat of Aston in Melbourne in the 2010 election, and since 2013 has held the important role of Parliamentary Secretary to the Prime Minister with a special responsibility for Indigenous affairs. And tonight Mr. Tudge is going to talk for us on the topic, the Andrew Forrest Report, Indigenous Employment and Closing the Gap. Andrew Tudge, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Jared, for that introduction, and welcome everybody, and thanks for being here on such short notice. And in part, the short notice was due to the launch of the Forrest Report, which was a moving target a little bit, and hence it was only a few days' notice. But thank you so much for coming here. Of course, I acknowledge the traditional owners, the Gadigal people. Thanks so much, Jared Henderson, for your work here at the Sydney Institute. There's so many other special guests here, including people like Danny Lester up the front, who do so much good work in Indigenous employment himself through the creation of the Aboriginal Employment Strategy. Last Friday, Andrew Forrest delivered to the government's perhaps one of the most ambitious reports in a generation. It outlines a blueprint with the goal of ending the disparity between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. It's huge in breadth and scope, and it's confronting to governments, to business, to Indigenous leaders and broader community members alike. The Prime Minister at the launch called it a watershed moment, possibly a marker in history. And I'd like tonight to outline some of the key ideas that are in this report and some of the government's thinking on them. And I might touch on how we could convert these ideas from simply being paper recommendations into something that might indeed live up to its stated ambition. But before doing so, let me give you some context of where the Forrest Report fits in. As you all know, one of the biggest social problems in our nation is the plight of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. On almost every measure, they fall behind other Australians. Life expectancy is 10 years behind, imprisonment is 15 times higher and 31 times higher for Indigenous youth. 15-year-old Indigenous students have fallen 2.5 years behind in schooling. The Indigenous employment rate is 30 percentage points lower. In remote communities, the data is catastrophic. Despite the volumes of cash in welfare payments, there is impoverishment in many places that's more akin to a poor developing country. If Helen Hughes was with us tonight, she would remind me not to overemphasise, though, those average results, as they hide the fact that there are also many Indigenous people who are middle class, who are working everyday jobs, they're buying their own homes, they're accumulating wealth and possessions. And indeed, Warren Mundine makes this point, rightly pointing out that Indigeneity does not equal disadvantage. But nevertheless, the economic and capability gaps cannot be ignored. In recent decades, there's been increasing goodwill in this area. There's been a formal end of discrimination, and there's been a steadily increasing financial commitments towards Indigenous advancement. But despite this, we haven't collectively had the progress which we'd like to achieve. In fact, in many locations, you would argue that the social fabric has got worse, not better. Initially, governments tried by budgets to provide material for Indigenous people, provide materially for Indigenous people, and expected them to maintain traditional or modernised lifestyles of their choice that had no or little economic rationale. When this didn't work, we've tried to address the problem with programs. And in many locations, the dominance of programs over normal development has been so complete that our policies amount to a large-scale controlled experiment inflicted upon 100,000 Australians who have been immersed in passive welfare for decades. There's been almost a simplistic one-to-one correspondence between symptom and response. If kids go to school hungry, governments start a breakfast program. If they are bored, we start a sport and rec program. If women feel unsafe, we start a women's shelter. Noel Pearson facetiously asks that now we have a life promotion program, when will we have the breathing program? Last year, an Auditor General's report into Indigenous communities found that, on average, an Indigenous community is serviced by one government program for every 5 members of the community. And it profiled Wilcannia here in western New South Wales, and it found in Wilcannia there were 102 funded programs from 18 state and federal agencies, with another 17 programs proposed. And the Indigenous population is 474. It's got to the point of ridiculousness in some communities where there is a whirlwind of service providers flying or driving in and out, and yet the social and economic indicators don't improve. And despite the advocacy of people like Pearson on this particular point, we never as a nation have collectively taken a step back and drawn the obvious conclusion that we're not going to close the gap with more programs. If this was the case, we would have closed the gap years ago. Instead, we need to be honest about the elephant in the room, that in the modern world, communities are functional and prosperous if kids go to school in the morning and parents go to work. If they don't, there tends to be systemic poverty and dysfunction. And no amount of service delivery or income support can prop up a community if kids aren't at school and the majority of adults aren't working. It's based on, in some respects, this simple insight that the Prime Minister has set the priorities for the federal government to ensure kids are at school, adults are at work, and communities safe. And underpinning these priorities is a bed of governance reform, amalgamating 150 federal Indigenous-specific programs into 5, placing them all within the Prime Minister's department and devolving decision-making power to the regional level so that there can be more local flexibility and greater empowerment of local leaders. And the Empowerment Communities Initiative will add to this. And of course, alongside this, we have an objective of constitutional recognition of Aboriginal people. And together, these three practical priorities, getting kids to school, adults to work, communities safe, alongside greater local empowerment and constitutional recognition, constitutes the overall Indigenous agenda from the federal government's perspective. And they aim to ensure that First Australians can have the opportunity, have the capability and the responsibility to reach their full potential as individuals and as families in a modern Australian society, while acknowledging and supporting their desire for a distinct Indigenous identity. Andrew Forrest was engaged to advise on the practical priority of getting adults working. But his report is broader than this, and indeed picks up many parts of the overall Indigenous Affairs agenda. He was chosen to head up this review of Indigenous employment in part because of his own success in Indigenous employment and training in his own company of Fortescue Metals. But while his report is influenced by his own experiences, his recommendations go beyond just training and employment. And he's gathered ideas from some of the best Indigenous thinkers in the nation, as well as academics, business leaders and community members. And so while his report is in his name, many of the concepts that he recommends were informed by other key thinkers, Noel Pearce and Warren Mundine, Marcia Langton, Ian Trust, Fiona Stanley, as well as consultations across the country. The strength of the report is that it pulls together many of the ideas into a framework which the governments can use, and all with the single objective of getting more people working. The starting point is education. And this is Andrew Forrest's opening chapter in his report. And a fundamental but often overlooked fact is that within each educational attainment level above Certificate 3, people have the same job outcomes as non-Indigenous people. And in fact, Indigenous women who have a tertiary degree get better job outcomes than non-Indigenous women with a tertiary degree. Now, this is important because it suggests that there's no, or at least little, elements of discrimination contributing to the overall employment gap. It's more a matter of getting sufficient numbers educated and trained, and in some cases geographically mobile. And so the very first thing we need to achieve for Indigenous children is a better start in life. In fact, often it's a better prenatal environment. And the Abbott government agrees with Andrew Forrest's strong recommendations for all governments in Australia to work together to achieve this as a matter of urgency. There are estimates that in some remote communities, the rate of fetal alcohol syndrome caused by excessive drinking during pregnancy is as high as 1 in 4, which is quite staggering when you think about that you are brain damaged from birth, and it's a rate as high as 1 in 4 in some communities. And this, of course, has to be addressed through better early pregnancy assistance, such as Forrest and Fiona Stanley recommend, but also could be through curbing alcohol, including the possible use of a cashless debit card for welfare payments if necessary. I think, and I've heard over the last few days, that there's a lot of talk about the rights of people to spend their welfare money as they please, but I would like to see equal concern for the rights of children to be born in a healthy manner. The next step in a child's development, enrolment and school attendance, much more needs to be done. Indigenous school attendance is 10 percentage points lower than non-Indigenous attendance. In remote areas, the attendance rate is only 60%. It's important to understand, though, that an attendance rate of 60% doesn't mean that students are learning 60% of the content. In fact, the experts will tell us that unless a student is attending at least 80% of the time, then they will effectively not be learning. And in remote Northern Territory, which is pretty much everywhere outside of Darwin, only 1/4 of Indigenous kids are attending at 80% of the time, which effectively means that 3/4 of those students aren't learning, aren't even attending school enough to be learning. And this is why, you know, we as a government are so determined to work with community leaders, work with the states and territories and school principals to change this. The first step, if you like, has been put in place, and that is putting local school attendance officers in place in 73 communities which have the lowest attendance rate. And already that has achieved quite considerable success. Indeed, the number of kids attending school this year compared to last year as a result of this measure is 17% higher. But it won't be enough. And the states and territories do need to do more, including enforcing some of their own truancy laws, as Andrew Forrest suggests. And despite the figures I told you about those attendance rates, there's probably fewer than 20 truancy fines that were issued last year for non-attendance. And we believe, as many Indigenous leaders have told us, particularly in the remote areas, that there does need to be consequences on parents who fail to send children to school. And we will step in if the states and territories do not. And we're not being over dramatic in suggesting this, because it is simply the fact that if kids aren't in school, another generation is destined for disengagement, for welfare dependency, and in many cases, imprisonment. Attendance, of course, is the start to good schooling, but effective instruction goes hand in glove. And ideally, we would put the best teachers in the lowest achieving schools, as Andrew Forrest suggests. It makes common sense, and while the states and the territories should work towards this admirable goal, I'm actually sceptical that it can be achieved in the near term. Because, at least in the Northern Territory, the average length of time that a teacher spends in a remote community is only 7 months. And so even if we could double this, triple this, it still may not be sufficient for that very effective teacher to turn around a school or turn around a classroom. And so therefore we need, in some respects, a teaching methodology that is easily transferable from one teacher to another and can accommodate that transience in teachers and accommodate the particular circumstances in those areas. And in part, this is why we are funding the organisation called Good to Great Schools, led by Noel Pearson, to roll out a methodology called Direct Instruction beyond Cape York Peninsula. And you may have read about this. There's been some debate about this in the Australian newspaper particularly. But I can tell you from my time when I was working up as Noel Pearson's deputy director in the Cape that I've seen schools such as Arakoon, which is a pretty tough school, completely transformed as a result of this particular teaching methodology. And it's based simply on several core principles. Firstly, having very tightly scripted lesson plans where teacher discretion is actually minimised, and it means that one teacher can leave today and another teacher can come in tomorrow and pick up exactly where a student is at on that lesson plan. The second principle is that there's regular and ongoing testing, indeed almost daily, such that if a person is falling behind, they will be picked up immediately, and that they won't advance to the next level if they haven't mastered the lesson from the previous level. And the third principle is that students are grouped by ability, not age. And it's almost common sense in a way to think this, that if a student is attending a class at a level above where they are at, they are going to disengage from that class and will not learn. And so I've seen in classrooms where there might be an 8-year-old child sitting alongside a 13-year-old child, but learning at the same rate. And I believe that many of these principles are, in many regards, common sense, but in some schools these would indeed be very radical proposals. Some will argue that, in some respects, the answer to the employment problem finishes here, that our entire focus should be getting the next generation educated. And certainly, as I mentioned before, if kids are healthy, if they attend and learn like anybody else, statistically, they will get employments like anybody else. But I caution people against this generation change concept. Firstly, I don't think it's right in principle to draw a line between generations and give up on the parents. But second, if adults are idle, there are too many distractions for kids to succeed. And we've heard this from our local school attendance officers on the ground, that it's just so much more difficult to get kids to school if the adults aren't engaged themselves during the day. And so we do need whole communities to be employed, or at least active, in order to get school attendance up and to give children the peace to thrive. And this is where the rest of the Forrest report comes in. Before Andrew began his review, his main thinking and his main critique in relation to Indigenous employment largely centred around training and employment services. And I can assure you, if you read the report, Andrew Forrest doesn't hold back in continuing this critique. And by and large, his critique, I believe, is justified. The training system, in many cases, is disconnected from employer demand. Training for training's sake is rife, particularly for Indigenous people. When you look at the figures, 89% of training funded through the job network, which is there to get people into employment, is in Certificate 1 and Certificate 2, which many employers don't value. And I've literally met Indigenous people who have 10 certificates to their name, but no job at the end of it. And an Aboriginal mayor once joked that the houses in his community were falling apart. And a social housing bureaucrat responded that, well, the government will look into this. Clearly we need to get a major housing program going to assist on this front. No, the mayor said, it's our framed certificates pulling the walls down. Forrest recommends no federal funding go towards Certificate 1 or 2 courses unless they are explicitly linked to a job. He suggests that Certificate 3 and 4 training courses, which are the more advanced courses, also have tighter links to employers through employer bodies certifying and assessing courses. And these are directionally where the government would like to go. Training must have stronger links to jobs. It's a waste of money and people's time to do training if there isn't ever going to be a job outcome associated with it. And I can tell you, I just recalled right now, I remember a discussion which I had up in Townsville with a round table of some Aboriginal people, and they said, do you know what the last training course that we were asked to do was? It was a Certificate 2 in active volunteering. And you didn't even have to volunteer to get it. One of the real innovations that Andrew Forrest developed and that the government has funded is what's called the VTEX, which stands for the Vocational Training and Employment Centres. And the concept of a VTEC, which is so different to ordinary training and employment services, is that the training is directly linked to a job outcome. If a job is not secured from the person doing the training, then that provider does not get paid. And it's amazing what a powerful incentive that becomes to get an individual through training in an efficient manner and to get a job and to stay in work for 26 weeks, because that's the model. And we've committed at the election to 5,000 places through a number of VTECs across the country. And already we have over 4,000 places in place, and by the end of the year we'll have all 5,000 places in place. And that what this means is that 5,000 training spots into guaranteed jobs for unemployed Indigenous people. Forrest goes further than this and suggests that our entire job network system, the JSAs as they're known, should be transformed into something more similar to the VTEX. And our draft JSA reform proposals, which are out for public consultation presently, certainly put much greater emphasis on outcomes-based funding. And perhaps Forrest's report may give those proposals a further nudge. A section of Forrest's report which has had very little public attention to date has been the recommendations to boost boost demand for Indigenous employees. There's been a lot of discussion on the supply side, if you like, but actually very little focus in the public domain on the demand side. And for many classic liberals, this is actually one of the toughest sections, because classic liberals tend to reject suggestions of targets or special measures. And Forrest's argument for them is a pragmatic one, and is based on the data. A, that the employment gap is already too large and is indeed growing. B, that it'll take too long to wait for early childhood and education measures to flow through. And I would add a C, as outlined above, that without more adults working, actually achieving education success is so much harder. The actual employment figures themselves are pretty stark. I mean, between 2008 in 2013, the Indigenous employment rate actually declined. It fell from 48.2% to now 45.9%. Over the last 5 years, the non-Indigenous employment rate of working age people increased to 76%. So there's now a 30 percentage point gap. And now the number of working age Aboriginal people reliant upon welfare for their main source of income is higher than the number who rely on a job. And when you look at the demographics, half the Indigenous population is below the age of 20. So we're going to have thousands more Aboriginal people going into employment age over the next 5 to 10 years. So we do need to change this trajectory. And even in a mining state like Western Australia, which you would think that over the last 5 years you'd see the employment rate skyrocket, in fact, even in that state, the employment rate has declined and is still below 50%. And I think that we are simply kidding ourselves about making any meaningful progress on other social indicators if these figures don't change. Forrest outlines four suggestions to boost demand. First, to increase public sector employment targets to 4% from the present 2.7%. Second, to support the top 200 companies to boost their Indigenous employment rate. Third, to use government procurement as a lever to support Indigenous business creation and therefore wealth. And fourth, to create a new tax-free status business for those Indigenous-owned businesses that employ a very high proportion of unemployed Indigenous people. These are strong measures, and there's going to be debate about the appropriate targets in these areas. Already, for example, the public sector has an employment target of 2.7%, which is about parity with the underlying Indigenous population. But I have argued publicly that our ambition should be parity across the board in all aspects of our society. And some companies already have stated this ambition themselves, and many other companies could do more, given that the current private sector employment rate is 0.5%, when parity would be 2.7% in their companies. Similarly, in procurement, our government procurements, the Commonwealth government procures about $39 billion worth of contracts each and every year. The amount that goes to Indigenous businesses last year was $6 million, or 0.01% of that Indigenous procurement. So there is more that could be done there as well. And potentially that's such a strong lever for Indigenous employment, because Indigenous businesses tend to engage and employ Aboriginal people at 100 times the rate of non-Indigenous businesses. I've discussed tonight Forrest's recommendations to boost education, recommendations to fix training, and his recommendations to boost demand. All could dramatically change the outcome in urban and regional areas. But it wouldn't be possible to have a discussion on Indigenous employment without squarely addressing the question of employment of people in the remote communities. And many remote communities, as you'd be aware, have no economic base and are unlikely to do so in the near future, although that's not the case with all communities. Employment rates in these communities, 30% overall, is 18% for 17 to 24-year-olds. Lost generations are created because of welfare money requiring little or no activity. Many communities, as you're aware, are alcohol-filled. Forrest doesn't have a dedicated chapter on this, but he has specific references and recommendations throughout his report. And in essence, he suggests three suites of measures derived from ideas of various Indigenous leaders across the country. First is the recommendation to end sit-down money. Passive welfare is a poison and becomes an attractive alternative destination to taking a job. And I have seen entry-level jobs in a remote community being filled by non-Indigenous people because of the inability to attract a local worker. Forrest recommends that every able person must be doing a constructive work for the dole initiative in exchange for welfare. And this is something that the government supports, because sit-down money has to end. because when people are active, they maintain their skills and they maintain their work habits. And it also is an encouragement to seek a fully paid job when work is available. Secondly, Forrest suggests land tenure reform to enable greater economic development opportunities on remote lands. Now, greater opportunities for individual land title is sought by a great many traditional owners, and that should be supported. How many work opportunities this would lead to is unknown, and of course would vary from location to location, but in some areas land tenure reform could indeed, well, in concert with good development opportunities, could lead to dozens if not hundreds of jobs. Certainly Helen Hughes was of the view that there was considerable economic development potential simply from land tenure reform alone, and she also concluded, as most development economists would, that development is impossible almost without land tenure reform and some sort of private property right underpinning it. A simple principle we think should apply, and that is if traditional owners want land tenure reform, they should be supported. And Indigenous Affairs Minister Nigel Scully is working with traditional owners to do this. And the third principle he suggests for the remote areas is changing the incentives to encourage mobility to where jobs are located. And every person, every citizen in this nation has a right to live in a place of their choice. This is indeed part of the citizenship contract. But government policy does impact on their decisions. And for the last few decades, government policy hasn't leant towards encouraging mobility. I would argue it hasn't even been neutral on that question, but it's actually encouraged immobility and staying stationary in areas which have very little economic opportunity. And the key policies that have done this are the welfare payments alone and housing policy, and particularly the latter. Because if you stay in a remote community, you will get a free house, which effectively becomes yours. You leave for a job and you enter into an expensive rental market. And the effect of this is that it becomes almost of no financial benefit for a family to leave a community to go to a regional centre to take up an entry-level job. And I did some calculations that a couple with three children today in a remote community, having paid for housing costs, would have about $42,000 in disposable income. If they moved to a regional centre to take up an entry-level job, or at least for the husband to do so, having taken into account the tax and losing some welfare benefits and rent, after housing costs, they would have about $44,000 of disposable income. And yet, of course, they'd lose their time, they'd be away from family, and they'd lose the house which may have been in their family for generations back on their home community. So the Forrest Report includes some valuable suggestions about how mobility can be facilitated, including how housing policy can change to support employment, not just shelter. And one of the core principles, in essence, is that any housing entitlement should be portable rather than just centrally located in a particular geographical area, particularly one where there may be few jobs. And Ian Trust, an Indigenous leader in the Kimberley, has done very good work on this particular question, and the report draws on this and builds on this. And of course, as a government, we have a broader policy to encourage young people particularly to be mobile, and indeed there are economic incentives for them to do so. There are other measures in the Forrest Report that I've not discussed tonight. He suggests a new governance model in remote locations to provide greater local empowerment. He makes constructive suggestions for dealing with royalty money. He makes specific recommendations, as you know, about implementing the creation of a creating parity website to track progress very transparently. And of course, he recommends a new debit card for all welfare payments to be placed upon, with limitations on cash withdrawals and certain products such as alcohol and gambling prohibited. So what happens now? None of these ideas which Forrest puts forward are Some will be fiercely challenged and may well be too far ahead of public opinion. Others would take time to put into practice. I often suggest that Forrester Report is a 5-year blueprint or a 10-year blueprint, not a 5-month blueprint. And local community leaders must be engaged at absolutely every step of the way to have any chance of change occurring and being successful. But the government is determined to make a difference. The Prime Minister has already established an implementation feasibility task force to assess the practicality of each of Forrester's proposals. And alongside this, we'll have an extensive consultation process over the next 6 or so weeks, which I will lead. And this will involve written submissions, it will involve dozens of face-to-face consultations across the country. This initial feedback and the feasibility assessment, as well as the ongoing advice from Warren Mundine and his Indigenous Advisory Council, will guide the government's broad response to the Forrester Report. And as measures are implemented, there will be ongoing engagement on the ground. But as Tony Abbott said at the launch of the report, this could be a defining moment in Australia's history, because never before have we had such an ambitious blueprint and a Prime Minister so committed to the advancement of Aboriginal people. And Forrester Report might not get implemented word for word, but it will become the guiding document for how the government approaches Indigenous affairs in the years ahead. We don't want 100 more programs. We don't want billions more spent. What we do want is to work with Indigenous leaders, with businesses and the broader community to ensure the kids are learning, that adults are working and that communities are safe. And there is so much goodwill in the community today for the advancement of Aboriginal people, and our challenge is to convert that goodwill into action, and the time is now. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Many thanks to the Honourable Alan Tudge MP. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got plenty of time, and I should say initially again thanks to the Gillibilly Club for providing this fine facility this evening. Some of the bars and restaurants are open after, so you're welcome to stay around. And now for questions and discussion. Thanks for a fine address. Report's only been out a couple of days. I know this is a difficult topic, but one of the topics you didn't cover, and you probably can't cover, is the issue of industrial relations. I mean, as you'll be aware, the worst thing that ever happened to Aboriginal employment in Northern Australia was the Cattle Industry Award of 1967, which effectively disenfranchised and disemployed whole lots of Aborigines who worked on cattle stations, some at award rates, some at under award rates, but they're all put on award rates. And as you know, there's also a large number of Indigenous Australians living in places like Western Sydney, where provisions like the unfair dismissal laws and the highest award wages in the Western world may be a disincentive. I mean, is there anything that the government can do in relation to the industrial relations system that might facilitate Indigenous employment? And is this the kind of thing that Andrew Forrest did look at, or that he might have looked at?
Andrew Forrest didn't look at that question, although it was raised from time to time. He went pretty broadly in his scope on his report already, and he didn't go as far as making recommendations on the broad industrial relations framework. Of course, there's no specific industrial relations framework for Aboriginal people, so any changes must be made across the board. Now, we've recommended and have a policy for some changes to be introduced, which we can introduce now. But as you know, Gerard, we're going to go through a process in the next 12 to 18 months to take more significant industrial relations changes to the next election.
Right, so there's a question down the back and then there's one here. Yes. Now, if I repeat the questions to make it sure it's picked up in our podcast, that's all. Yep.
Hi, Alan. Carl Kraft, CEO of Supply Nation. We connect corporate Australia with Indigenous businesses and get them to access
You've got to speak up, I can't hear.
Into their supply chain. So We've been working with the government on one of the recommendations around procurement, and I don't think it gets enough attention because the report is quite large. There's been a lot of talk about welfare, so I would focus a little bit for the time being on this procurement question.
Okay.
One of the things is that there's an opportunity for a lot of money, more than $1 billion potentially, for businesses to access the government's procurement bucket. But I suppose just a warning that should come with a little bit of heart, because the JSA has made a lot of money, and those were implemented with the best of intentions, and Indigenous outcomes were the greatest payments. So I would think there should be some onus on the businesses themselves if they don't perform, and should be penalised as well. Because I think some
money
too much.
Okay, so there's a question about procurement.
Yep. And then on the JSAs.
But just tell us what the JSAs are. Okay.
Firstly, on procurement, which I touched on in this speech, and I've had ongoing conversations with Charles, who does a fantastic job as the head of Supply Nation. As I said, our procurement spend is currently on Indigenous businesses is currently 0.01% of the overall Commonwealth spend on businesses, and I think we can do better. In the United States, President Nixon introduced legislation in 1969, which has had a dramatic impact on boosting the African American middle class, largely through procurement policy. Because if you're supporting Indigenous entrepreneurs, through them you'll also support Indigenous employees. On the second question on the JSAs is a job network. In essence, they're the people you go to if you're on unemployment benefits to help you get work, and they manage the compliance system for you. They tend to have got very poor outcomes for Aboriginal people. Now, we've gone through a process of reforming the JSAs. There's a document out of presence which we're asking for public feedback on. And it has a lot more outcomes-based payments. There's an opportunity, Charles, to make submissions in relation to that as to whether or not it should go further. Certainly the Forest Report argues it should go considerably further.
Question here, Roderick. Yes.
Roderick West. I think a debit card is a most marvellous idea. I mean, I wish my father had given me a debit card when I was 18. It just seems to me to be so simple. But why isn't it for everybody on welfare? Why should this be for Indigenous people? And why shouldn't it be right across the board?
Well, there's a question about the debit card.
So many problems.
So this is the idea which has had the most public exposure over the last few days, and in fact the recommendation in the report is that it does apply across the board.
Exactly.
It does apply across the board.
Such a hassle on Q&A last night.
In part it's a bigger question, and it's obviously there's a lot of people who argue that you inhibit individual freedom by putting any restrictions on how their welfare payments should be spent. I think in certain circumstances there should be such limits on how welfare is spent, and indeed already in many places in Australia there is what's called a basics card in place, which does limit what you can spend, and the idea here is to indeed to help vulnerable people, particularly with their budgeting, and it can be an effective tool with their budgeting to ensure that there's food on the table, to ensure that there's shelter which is paid for. And we're going to take a very close look at it.
Can we put in tomorrow?
Okay. All right. So, this question down the back. Yeah.
Andrew Forrest strongly makes a point about the interdependency of his recommendations. You've commented about the controversy in some of those recommendations. Do you agree with Forrest about the interdependency? And if so, how do you rate the chances of success in only implementing some of them?
The question about the Forest Report's recommendation that its recommendations should all go together, should be interdependent. Yeah.
It's a good question. That is a central recommendation of Andrew Forrest, is every recommendation should be implemented. We're not making a conclusion today. We are going through a deliberate consultative exercise over the weeks ahead to get feedback from the broader community on exactly which ones have some broader support and which ones do not, as well as we're going to assess the practical feasibility of some of the recommendations. Recommendations are geared at not just the federal government, but at state governments, at businesses, and at individual communities in some instances. So we have to work through this. But I believe it is a very good framework, for us to approach the problems. But we want to be deliberate and methodical about working through them.
Sharon Browning, Newcastle University. Hello.
Hello, Sharon. How's it going?
Lovely to see you. I think that more of the same is going to beget more of the same. So I think that everyone in this room and right across the board, you know, implores you to do something differently, to be brave and make a change, make a difference. A generation of children are being lost, and the next one. So, you know, determination to do something different. There's strong, broad community support, regardless of TV programs, regardless of the hype in the media that you make profit. The broader communities do want change, and they want you to do something, and they're very supportive that you'll make a difference and do things differently to bring about change, particularly for the next few generations. And indeed, families that are living there want better for their own children. So, you know, consult, you know, be collaborative, but please make a difference.
The suggestion is the broader community wants you to have a go and do something different.
I think that's right. I mean, it's the definition of insanity to think that you can do exactly the same thing and get a different result. There does need to be change, and we've certainly got a very committed Prime Minister and government who is committed to change, but also acknowledging that you must work in partnership with Indigenous community leaders in order for change to be successful.
We've had a question. Hang on just a second. There's a question here. Yeah, okay. We've got to speak up a bit. Okay?
Peter Shoquist, Andrew, Alan. The question I have is direct instruction. How does it go for in terms of grades? What happens when it finishes direct instruction? Do you go into another phase? Tell us the story about Andrew Pinfold's success in the Australian Indigenous Education Fund, and I think Brendan Nelson was instrumental in starting that when he was the Minister. And what is the potential of expanding that rapidly when the boarding schools and the cities can take more students if they have the funding?
Okay, so the question about direct instruction, you may need to background that a bit.
So direct instruction, which I mentioned in my address, is the particular teaching methodology which Pearson has introduced into several Cape York schools. It applies in the primary schools, but there's no reason it can't apply in secondary schools as well. The second question was in relation to boarding schools. Now, we support... The Australian Indigenous Education Foundation is a phenomenally good organisation, and indeed Andrew Pinfold was chosen to be on the Prime Minister's Indigenous Advisory Committee. From memory, it has several hundred students who have come from remote areas to be placed into boarding schools, and they tend to get good results, although it is very hard, because often they'll come from primary schools which are... They might be the best in their school, but still 2 or 3 years behind by the time they transfer to a secondary school. We're very supportive of Andrew's organisation. It's well funded presently. He's still gearing up with the funding that he has. He continues to argue for additional funds to support more opportunities. It's also outlined in the Forest Report that we need to look at this to ensure that that as many people as possible can have those opportunities. So I'm not going to say today what's going to happen in relation to that, Peter, but philosophically there's very strong support with it.
Especially on the back here. So there's a question about Wilcannia, 2 hours from Broken Hill, nothing ever happens, and you've heard the arrest. So the question is, how do you handle a situation like Wilcannia?
The I touched on it towards the end in terms of how do you think about the more remote communities where there is no economic base there, and arguably Wilcannia doesn't have that economic base to support that number of people into jobs. The Forest's recommendation is, A, you have to at least get everybody doing constructive community activity on the ground. Now, that's easier said than done, but that has to be the first ambition, so that skills can be developed from doing that, and so that there's a greater incentive to actually want to go out and take a real job, because if you're already working just for your dole, you might as well be working for twice as much money. The second point, though, in relation to that as well, is that we have to be supporting greater mobility. We have to be supporting greater mobility. Now, we've got a mainstream program now, which was just introduced into the Parliament and started on the 1st of July, which provides up to $6,000 for an individual and $9,000 for a family to move, for an unemployed family or individual to move to take up work elsewhere. If we can combine that with some of the housing proposals which Andrew Forrest put forward, and some case management assistance, if you like, which Andrew recommends, then I think that you can start to see some sizeable change on that front. And that's, that's of course one of the answers as well, is that over time, I mean, in the more remote communities, there often are a lot of white workers, and ideally they should be replaced by local workers to upskill them and work towards that. But typically, as you know, Dave, that will only get you so far. That might get you to 25 or to 40% of the working age population employed by doing that. But it won't get to 75%, which is the mainstream average. So that's where you do have to think differently. And, you know, Pearson, as you know, talks about orbiting. You know, people going out, you know, from Cape York to New York, as he would say. But even from Cape York to down to Cairns to get a job and then come back to your home, to your homelands in the holidays. And that's a concept which we want to at least encourage and make it rational for people to be able to do that. Whereas at the moment, as I was saying, is many of the incentives are actually geared towards staying put rather than to being mobile to where job opportunities might be.
Okay, right down that gap. Yep.
As with white communities, European communities, Western world communities, there have always been huge disturbances, industrial revolution, tsunami. There's always been times where there are masses of people in need of leadership and being brought forward and moved up, Salvation Army, whatever. When you talk about Wilcannia, and you talk about some of the Aboriginal leadership of the sort of next level down, because it seems to me that Wilcannia needs a leader, or needs someone in the community who's part of the group to show the way, like
North Eastern's
done in Cape York. Can you see some of this development?
There's a question about Aboriginal leadership generally. Dave Lydiard and Charles and Danny would be able to comment on this as well, as would Tony Berg, who heads up JAR and is down the back there. There are some phenomenal leaders out there presently, and many of them are absolutely stepping up and wanting to take responsibility. And it's not just Noel Pearson, but there's a group called the Empowered Communities, which is 8 different regions from across the nation, where those leaders have actually stepped up and saying that we want to accept more responsibility placed upon us for the accountabilities on the ground, on school attendance, on employment, on safer communities, on other social norms. And that's very encouraging to see, and I think governments need to back those leaders. In some other communities, there is a weakness of leadership, and I think, Dave, you'd probably say the same, where you don't have the same capacity as in others. And it's more difficult in those where there isn't the real capacity on the ground, but it's not impossible. I said before, though, if you're not engaging with the local leaders on the ground and bringing those along in a partnership, it becomes exceptionally difficult to have any meaningful and sustainable change.
Dennis.
Alan, thanks for the presentation. It's important about, you mentioned employment, you mentioned the school. What about increasing the functionality of families? children and dysfunctional families, the parents are properly engaged as well as in employment, but just socially as well.
Question about functioning families.
In some respects, I mean, I would make the case, and this is not Indigenous or non-Indigenous, that functional families are when the adults are working and the kids are going to school. And that we sometimes flip it around where we say we have to address every single individual problem first before we can suggest that an individual can take even a part-time job. Whereas I think more of the research now is saying actually taking a job will address a lot of those problems. And mental health is a good example of that, where most of the modern research now will say you can't get mentally healthy first before you can then take a job. Taking a job will help your mental health.
There's a question, I've got to be brief now, yes?
Dear Simple, you mentioned the direct teaching as a methodology to help deal with the more structured learning for greater continuity of learning, given the high turnover of teachers in remote areas. And I think you mentioned the average of 7 months. Mm. Is there any strategy being put in place, recognising that's a good methodology, in relation to greater permanency of teachers in locations?
Is it likely you can get teachers to stay for more than 7 months?
To stay for more than 7 months. There is. Various states and territories have different methods and different incentive programs in place to do that. It's largely outside of the control of the federal governments because we don't employ any teachers. In Western Australia, they do things slightly differently, and the tenure consequently is longer than in the Northern Territory. Forrest makes recommendations that there needs to be significantly greater incentives to encourage people to stay, and particularly to encourage the best teachers to go to the remote communities rather than necessarily the most junior ones, which sometimes occurs presently.
So the second last question down there, here. Yes.
What's the significance of English as the medium of teaching? Is this in fact mandatory? And if not, you're not going to get anywhere, are you?
Question about the English language in schools.
I thought there was a great discussion about this on Q&A last night. I don't know if you watched that. And I'd probably defer to that discussion on that. At the end of the day, I think you have to learn English to be engaged in the Australian economy, but that doesn't mean that you can't be bilingual and also maintain your own Indigenous language. But to suggest that you can get by without English in modern Australian society, I think is incorrect.
I take a very brief question there, and then we've got to go. Yep.
Margaret Bell from Chain Reaction Foundation. I'm wondering if there's consideration within government. I think it's marvellous that people are trying to strive forward and see how Aboriginal people can be part of the economy. And education, as we know, is essential. But I'm wondering, I work with many Aboriginal families in Western Sydney and find that the children going to school are definitely strongly discriminated against still. Even in the independent boarding schools, which are doing their very best bring Aboriginal young people on board, they are experiencing discrimination. Is the government considering ways and means of educating the wider Australian population about the value of Aboriginal?
Okay, so there's a question about this.
Instead of still speaking about Aborigines who need support.
Okay, there's a question about discrimination against Indigenous Australian schools and whether the broader population shouldn't be educated out of this.
Listen, I wish that everybody could go and attend Charles Prowse's function of Supply Nation, which is here, was held here at the Town Hall and has, 1,000 people there, Charles, and it is the most incredible celebration of Indigenous achievement that I go to. Where all of these Indigenous business leaders are being celebrated for their achievements. Now, I wish that everybody could see that and there'd be much greater visibility of the overall Indigenous achievement because there are so many incredible Indigenous achievers. We've got at least 3 in this room that I'm aware of.
So finally, tell us about yourself.
Point. The other thing is that our discussion on constitutional recognition is in part about doing that as well, in terms of saying that And I liked Nova Peris's comment last night, where you don't lose 200 years of history, you'll gain 40,000 years of history for the rest of Australia through constitutional recognition. So that has to go hand in glove, and it's indeed why we've got some of these things going on in parallel.
So finally, tell us about yourself. You went from a period as Boston Consulting to a period at the Deputy Director of the Cape York Institute. What drove you to take that kind of employment?
Well, initially I got involved on a secondment basis, if you like. I came back from Harvard Business School and had an opportunity to go and work with Noel Pearson back in the year 2000, and Tony Berg was there, and I thought there were some interesting people and I might be able to offer something just for a few months. That ended up spurring a now what is a national initiative called JARWIN, which provides lots of corporate secondees into remote Indigenous communities to work alongside with Aboriginal organisations. 1,000 people have now gone. It's a phenomenal initiative which Tony Berg chairs. Later on, it's the position of Deputy Director came up. It was the time when there was some really significant reforms which were being designed, welfare reforms. It was the first time when conditional income management was being put in place. It was the first time when local empowerment structures were being put in place and housing reforms being prosecuted. And I wanted to go and offer whatever I could to Noel Pearson, who I thought and still do think is possibly Australia's greatest intellect. And you know, I personally gained immensely from that process, including in my own political developments in terms of how I think about social problems and deep, difficult social problems which you have at the acute end of the spectrum in remote communities.
Alan, many thanks. I'll be very brief. We had other questions that we had to sort of finish off, so I'll be very quick. Alan Todd is certainly a young politician who's made a very big impact in a short time, and a very impressive performance here tonight, of both of commitment and of understanding. We did this in a great hurry. We're very pleased to have the opportunity to have a discussion on the Forest Report so soon after it was released, and we've had it today from the Parliamentary Secretary. We're very happy that it's been televised. It'll be on our podcast tomorrow. It'll be published by Anne Henderson in the Sydney paper shortly. But for tonight, Alan, well done and thank you.
Thanks, Jerry.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.